All right, we're back with another episode of Journey to the Hoop, and I'm really excited about this one because we have a special guest, my dad, Brian Winters, and we will talk all about his basketball journey, where he started, his career through college, the NBA, and post-NBA, and then what he's up to these days. So, Dad, welcome.
Thank you.
So I'm going to ask you a lot of questions that I know the answers to, but obviously that'll just be for any listeners to get them that information. But I think I have some questions that I am not sure of the answer to, so it'll be interesting for me as well. So let's just start with, can you tell us where you were born and what your childhood was like?
Well, I was born in Rockaway Park, New York, which is part of the borough of Queens to New York City. It's also part of Long Island. It's at the entrance to New York Harbor, basically. But it is part of the borough of Queens, part of New York City. And I went to a Catholic grammar school there. I was raised there, two blocks from the beach. Walked two blocks. I was in the Atlantic Ocean. Walked one block, and I was in Jamaica Bay. So I grew up around the water and the beach.
Yeah,
so it was a good childhood.
Yeah, and I mean, you grew up in New York, and I guess I don't know, kind of the basketball heyday. I think where there was a lot of players growing up. I mean, there's still a lot of players that come out of New York, but I think back when you were growing up, and then a few years after you were out of there, I mean, there was a lot of really good players coming out of there.
Yeah, there were. New York was a hotbed for basketball, and at one time, I think, three to four of every NBA team had a New York player on it. It's not the case anymore. A lot of kids who grew up in New York now go to a prep school for high school and just leave out of New York City and do that, which is unfortunate, but that's the reality of it. But it was a hotbed for basketball. Everybody loved it. We used to go to the park and choose sides and go play. We didn't have AAU and referees and uniforms and all that business. We would just go to a park and play against each other, yeah. Whether it was in summertime or anytime on the weekends.
What was your what's your earliest basketball memory of either you playing or watching it or going to catch a game or something like that?
Well, until the sixth grade, I just played kind of all sorts of sports. And in New York, you grew up with stick ball and stoop ball and all these silly little games, beach games on the beach, beach volleyball, all sorts of things. So you played a lot of street games. But the first organized basketball I played was in the sixth grade, and I played for my Catholic grammar school in what was the CYO League, which is a Catholic youth organization. And that was my first introduction to, organized basketball, where you had a uniform, you had referees, you had games, et cetera. And from there, I did that for 3 years in grammar school, and then I went off to high school. But that was my first time I played organized basketball, and I started on my sixth grade team because I was the tallest, not necessarily the best player. There were a couple other guys who I grew up with that were better than me at the time. But by the time the eighth grade rolled around, I was the best player.
Yeah. What, why do you think you gravitated towards basketball rather than some of the other sports? Do you think it was because that was the sport in New York City, or was it something else, something with your mom or dad or brothers, sisters?
Well, it was a little bit of everything. I mean, I grew to like it. Once I went from the worst player of the starters, because I was tall at sixth grade, to the best player in eighth grade, then I really got interested in it. But up till that point, even till eighth grade, I almost went to high school to go play football. My father had played football at Miami of Ohio, and I almost went to a high school to go play football and try to be a wide receiver. But then I decided, once I got to eighth grade and had some success at it, that I decided I wanted to go to high school to play basketball. And even what happens in eighth grade when I was in grammar school was you took what was called a cooperative exam. It was a citywide Catholic high school exam, and you scored on it. And then you had to list four schools that you were interested in applying to. And then you would apply, and they would either accept you or reject you. And actually, the high school I went to, I put down fourth on my list because I had to do that in like October, November. But by the time March, April rolled around, that was the high school I really wanted to go to. So my father had to go over there and talk to the coach, and he got me into Archbishop Molloy. And it was the best place for me. So it was a good place.
So you ended up going to Archbishop Molloy for high school, which is a legendary New York City school, and coached by the legendary Jack Curran. Can you talk about your experience at that high school for a little bit and Coach Curran?
Well, yeah, it was an excellent high school for basketball at the time. And at that time, I played freshman basketball. Then I tried out for the varsity team when I was a sophomore. But myself and another kid who was a sophomore tried out, and I got cut. And I was absolutely teed off at that happening, because I thought I was good enough to make the team. But in retrospect, I think it was maybe one of the best things that ever happened to me, because it made me work harder and be more determined to be a good player.
Yeah.
Having been cut and having to face some adversity.
Who was the other player?
His name was Bob Bogad, and his brother Rudy played at St. John's, who was older and had been a good player at St. John's. And Bob Bogad went on to play in college, but I can't remember exactly where he went to school. But I played varsity basketball as a junior and a senior, and then that was when I played for Jack Curran. Up to that point, I had different coaches.
Yeah.
A couple of brothers, Maris brothers, ran the school, and two of the Maris brothers were the coaches at the time for the freshman and sophomore year.
Yeah. So you played. So you said freshman team as a freshman, then JV as a sophomore, and then last 2 years on the varsity team.
Right. Correct.
Okay. And what was that varsity experience like playing with Coach Curran? I mean, I know you guys had some really good teams. Who were some of the other good players on there? And, you know, what was that whole experience like?
Well, it was a great experience. My 4 years in high school, I played in the city championship every year. I won it my freshman year, lost it my sophomore year, and won it my junior year, and lost it my senior year. But as a varsity player, we played Power Memorial High School, which was a powerhouse high school in New York at the time. They had Lenny Elmore, Ed Searcy, and Jeff Trimble, who were three high school All-Americans. And my junior year, it was myself, Kevin Joyce, who was a high school All-American also, who I ended up playing in South Carolina with. And then we had other good players on the team, Tom Brethel and Kevin Raftery and Kevin Kluse. Kevin Kluse went on to play St. John's, as did Kevin Raftery. You know, most of the guys on my high school team ended up going to play various places in college. In fact, Mike Sorrentino was my point guard for 4 years in high school, and he was a starter my senior year, and he played at Davidson College. So we had a lot of other good players, and, as I said, we had great success. We won the championship my junior year, beating Power, which was an upset. It was played at Fordham University. And then my senior year, we played at St. John's, and we lost to basically the same Power team. They were just simply better our senior year than we were.
Yeah, yeah. And who were the guys they had? You said.
Well, I had Lenny Elmore, who played at Maryland, mm-hmm. and Jeff Trimble played at Maryland. Lenny Elmore went on to a 10 or 12 year NBA career, and he does announcing on television now. And Ed Searcy played at St. John's and Duquesne, and I think he probably went overseas to play. So they were very formidable. High school team. They were big. Nobody on our team was bigger than 6'4 or 5, and they were 6'8, 6'7, and 6'6 on the front line. So it was a challenge.
Yeah, and I know you always talk about when you were playing there at Archbishop Molloy, the style you guys played was just get up and down, press full court, you know, just run.
We did. We played, we pressed every game, and we played in the open court, got easy baskets, and we just overwhelmed teams most nights. However, in that championship run that we played, because they were so much bigger than us my junior year, we played some 2-3 zone just because we physically couldn't handle them one-on-one. But we pressed early in the game and most of the game. Then we went to a 2-3 zone, which they did not handle that well or shoot that well against. And then we went back to our press at the end of the game, and then we ended up winning because of it. So, we would do what we had to do, but mainly we were just a man-to-man, up and over play, try to steal balls, full court press, and get out in transition and run.
Yeah. And what? When did you start realizing or thinking about how you could go play in college? And, when did college coaches start to recruit you? Do you remember?
Well, I mean, I know I was one of the better players in high school. And then, you know, I spent 2 summers in a row at Kutcher Sports Academy between my sophomore and junior year, my junior and senior year, which is about 100 miles north of New York City in Monticello, New York. And I went to a basketball camp there for 8 weeks, and then Jack Kern's camp on the either end of it. So basically I went 10 weeks, 2 summers in a row to play. And by the time my junior year rolled around, people, you know, were starting to be interested. I knew that. And Kevin Joyce was a year ahead of me. He was a terrific high school player and a very good college player. And he played in the pros. Unfortunately, he tore his knee up and ended his career. But, you know, he was a really good player in high school, better player than I. He averaged 33 points a game and 18 rebounds in his senior year. My senior year, I averaged 24 points and 10 rebounds. So that'll give you an indication what kind of high school player he was. So they were all recruiting him, but also they saw me. So I was getting recruited too. So I found out my junior year that people were interested in. My senior year, I knew they were. And Jack Curran would keep me apprised. But, you know, he didn't let them come around too much. He kind of controlled it for me, which was good.
Yeah. So you ended up – can you talk about your four final schools? Which schools were they, and who were the coaches there at the time?
Yeah. My four schools were North Carolina, which Dean Smith was there. South Carolina, which Frank McGuire is where I went to play. Davidson, Terry Holland was the coach at the time. And then Marquette, where Al McGuire was the coach at the time. And I chose South Carolina, you know, basically because Frank McGuire, who had been at North Carolina, recruited an awful lot of New York players over the years. And from Larry Brown and Doug Moe to, you know, Donnie Walsh, who's the GM, has been the GM for the Pacers for years. Billy Cunningham, all those guys. And then when he went to South Carolina, he did the same. He recruited John Roach, Tom Owens, Tom Riker, myself, Mike Dunleavy, Kevin Joyce. So we had, you know, kind of what they used to call it, pipeline, like the New York City pipeline to the South. And, you know, so I ended up going to South Carolina. If I hadn't gone there, I probably would have picked North Carolina because I did like Coach Smith. And I did like the university, and so, but I picked South Carolina, and that's where I went.
Yeah. What was that like, making the change from New York City to South Carolina?
Well, it was 1970. It was quite a change. You know, I had grown up in a big city, played against all sorts of varied people, and going to South Carolina, it was, you know, a little bit going back in time in a sense that, you know, it was just at the end of desegregation, or the start of desegregation, I should say. And, you know, I actually played one of the guys who I played with in college, who was a year ahead of me, named Casey Manning. He was the first black basketball player to play at South Carolina. At the time, I didn't really recognize the significance of it because I had played against black players all my life in New York. But he was the first black player to play at South Carolina. So looking back on it, it was historic. And Casey and I used to play against each other every day in practice. And he was a great guy. He became a lawyer, and then he's been a judge in South Carolina for years.
Oh, that's cool. I don't actually think I knew that. So there you go. Well, cool. What can you talk a little bit about your career at South Carolina, and you know, what were your teams like? And actually, you know, I believe right, there was like a freshman team back then, right?
Right. You weren't allowed to play varsity basketball as a freshman. So I played on a freshman team, and Donnie Walsh, as I said earlier, who had been the GM, he'd been a coach. He played for Dean Smith at North Carolina and was Frank McGuire's assistant coach. He coached the freshman team, and Donnie still works for the Pacers as a consultant now, but had been the GM with the Pacers for years. He also coached in the NBA with Larry Brown, particularly with the Nuggets. And so Donnie was my freshman coach, and being recruited there, I said to him, Donnie, where are you going to play me as a freshman? And he said, where do you want to play? And I said, I want to be the point guard. Because I knew if I wanted to be an NBA player, I had to learn to be something different than what I was in high school. So I played point guard my whole freshman year in college. And my roommate at the time, Eddie Peterson, was a great shooter and played as a two guard, but he couldn't handle the ball and make plays. He was the leading scorer on the team, which I was fine with. But I learned to play point guard. I learned to bring the ball up against pressure. I learned to, you know, initiate offense. I needed to learn how to balance the both of, you know, getting your teammates involved, but also scoring yourself, and which is not easy to learn. And so it was a great experience actually playing freshman basketball, and I tried to use it to my advantage as for my future if I wanted to be an NBA player. I think just having more versatility would help me. So
yeah, and
as a freshman, I played point guard.
Yeah, I mean, is that really something that you just kind of thought about on your own? Like, shoot, if I want to get to the NBA, I need to handle the ball better, so I should play point guard? Or did some of the coaches talk to you about that as well? Because that seems pretty that would be a hard choice for a young kid to make, to choose to play freshman rather than, you know, on the varsity team in college.
Well, I couldn't play on the varsity as a freshman, so I had to play freshman basketball. So I said, well, I know I could score a lot of points. I could be the leading scorer. I could do whatever. But I knew if I wanted to have a chance to be an NBA player, I needed more versatility. And so that's the reason. And no coach talked to me about it. I did that on my own.
Okay. Yeah, well, that's impressive, you know, just because I think back to when I was younger and you know, those choices and I don't know, you know, just having the foresight to see that far ahead is pretty remarkable. So what did your, you know, sophomore, juniors and senior year look like? How was the team? What was the best year for you guys as a team? And just, you know, kind of what did the rest of your career there look like?
Well, I really didn't have that great of a college career, to be quite honest with you. You know, I'd gone to South Carolina wanting to play in the ACC. And after my freshman year, they dropped out of the ACC and we became an independent. And, you know, I was always disappointed in that a little bit because I wanted to play against the North Carolinas and the NC States and the Marylands. And, you know, I wanted to play in that league. But, you know, you make the most of it. My sophomore year, I played as the sixth man or seventh man on the team. You know, at that time, they had junior and senior players who had more experience than you. And we had good players, and John Roach, Tom Owens, Kevin Joyce, Danny Traylor, Tom Riker. You know, there were some good players. And and Bob Carver was another guy from my high school who was 2 years ahead of me. So they got the first shot at, you know, playing more, and you had to somewhat wait your turn. So I played off the bench as a sophomore and played okay, nothing special.
Was Bobby Kremins your same year, or where does he fall into that mix?
Bobby Kremins had just graduated when I was coming in as a freshman. He had just graduated as a senior.
When
John Roach and Tom Owens, and those guys were seniors when I was a freshman.
Okay.
So my sophomore year was just, you know, I played off the bench and did a solid job, and we won. We had a good year, not a great year. I think we made the NCAA tournament. I can't remember exactly what. Oh, I know what happened. I don't remember exactly. But we made the NCAA tournament. I can't remember who we played. My junior year, I thought we were going to have a great year. I was going to be in the backcourt with Kevin Joyce, and we were probably going to be one of the best backcourts in America, if not the best. And unfortunately, I got mononucleosis and kind of ruined the whole year for me, to the point where at one point I almost thought about quitting. But because I just could never get in tip-top shape to be the player I wanted to be. And I would always get two-thirds or three-quarters of the way through the game, and I would be drained of energy and just barely get through the rest of the game. So my stats and everything went way down. You know, I played as a small forward that year, just out of necessity. But we did win an NCAA game the first year. I think we beat Texas. I think it was either A&M or Tech. I can't remember which. And then we went and we lost to the Memphis team that ended up playing UCLA in the final. And they were a very good team. And then my senior year, we made the NCAA tournament. And we had to play Furman, and they made two South Carolina teams go all the way to the Palestra in Philadelphia and play. And we ended up losing. We were up 14 points with about 12 minutes to go. And we just gave the game away. I was the only senior on the team. I started one freshman and three sophomores, and we had good play. We had Alex English and Mike Dunleavy and myself, and then a couple of a freshman player was, you know, really a terrific athlete, and Bob Mathias was our center, who was from New York too, about 6'8". But we ended up just, I don't know, all of a sudden we went haywire and just took bad shots and ended up losing to Furman. And I have to say, after the game, I was steamed. But we probably would have lost next, because then we would have had to play David Thompson's NC State team in the Eastern Regional, and that wasn't going to happen. And at that time, the NCAA was only 32 teams. It wasn't 64 teams.
Oh, okay. So, I mean, you had to have a pretty good senior year, though, individually, right? Because then you went on and got drafted, what, number 12, 14?
Right. I was 12, first round, 12th pick by the Lakers. I did have a good senior year. I took almost the whole summer off because I had mono. I just wanted to rest, and I didn't play a lot. But when I came back to school, I just re-energized myself and got myself in the best condition I could possibly get in. And then I went out, and, you know, I averaged 20 points a game, shot 50% from the floor, and we won 23 games. So we had a good year. But unfortunately, as I said, we lost to Furman in an NCAA tournament, so that was a little disappointing finish.
Yeah. So then you got drafted 12 by the Lakers.
Right.
And what year was this? 74?
Yeah, it was 1974, and actually – what happened was Johnny Walsh called me and says, Larry Brown would like you to come and try out for this AAU team, and they're going to go to Russia and Finland. And I said, well, when is it? And he said, well, it's like end of May, June. And so I said, well, that'll mean a missed graduation. And he goes, yeah, you will. And then so I had to call my parents and say, look, I'm not going to walk at graduation if I go on this trip, but I'd like to go. So Larry Brown and Doug Moe were the coaches. We met up in Chapel Hill. Practiced for a week, went back home for a day or two, and then we flew over and played over there. And it wasn't until we got to Helsinki, Finland, about 3 weeks later, that I found out where I got drafted. Because at that time, there was no green room and this big production of the draft. I was in Helsinki, Finland, and Larry Brown came back. He had talked to somebody back in the States and said, you got drafted by them, and you were the 12th pick in the first round of the Lakers. You were drafted by Cleveland. You were drafted by him. And he told us all of us where we got drafted, and we had no idea.
Who else was on that trip?
A guy named Fritz Walker, who played in the NBA a long time. Let's see, I got to think. Leonard Gray, he played in the NBA for a while. I'm trying to think who else. There were a couple other guys who played in the NBA, but I'm losing track of them. But
no,
we went to
a
Russia.
Long time ago.
We went to Russia, played their Olympic team, who had beat our Olympic team in '72 in that. Kind of upset, which was really right. Wasn't an upset. It was really highway robbery. But we played them twice in Moscow. We beat them once, and they beat us. And then we went on and played in a bunch of other cities, in Tallinn and Riga and Kiev. And then we went off to Finland and played in Helsinki and another town. So it was an interesting trip.
Right. So then you got back, and you were a Laker. What was that like? Was it that about that time Jerry West was kind of a winding down his career? Isn't that correct?
Yeah, we went to training camp and Jerry worked out for 2 weeks and he decided to retire. He was 36 years old at the time. He knew the team wasn't going to be very good, and he just had enough, and so he retired. But I did play against them for 2 weeks in practice. And you know, all along people had said, well, Jerry can only go right. The only problem was he went right whenever he wanted to. So I found that out real quick.
Yeah.
And but, you know, I play with a lot of older veteran players on that team, and we weren't really a good Laker team. But the guys were older, and they were all winding down their careers. Elmore Smith and I, and, Kermit Washington were the younger guys. We had Pat Riley, Gail Goodrich, Zelmo Beatty, Connie Hawkins, Lucius Allen, you know, Cassie Russell, you know, all these guys were 30 to 35, and, you know, they were coming to the end of their careers. And so we ended up winning, I think we were 30 and 52 with the Lakers. But I had a good year, and, you know, started off playing some early, then didn't play at all for two, 3 weeks. And I finally went to an assistant coach. I said, you know, you're getting no scoring out of two of your forwards. And they were good guys, Happy Harrison and, I forget the other guy, but they couldn't score. They were very good defenders and played hard. I said, you know, I played some small forward. I can play small forward, at least give you some points from that position. So I didn't play for another 2 weeks, just garbage time. And all of a sudden I'm in New York in my hotel room, and the phone rings about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And it's the assistant coach. His name is John Barnhill. And he says, get ready. You start against Bill Bradley tonight in the Garden.
Against Bill Bradley in the Garden. How was that?
Yeah. It was interesting. I got abused. It was those old Knick teams that were really good, the Buschier and Bradley and you know, Walt Frazier, and they were really good. Jerry Lucas, all those guys. Now Earl Monroe, and they moved the ball so well. They executed their offense so well. Bill Bradley just ran me around off picks all night, making shots and then reversing me and all sorts of stuff. So I got a lesson early about it, and that was fine. And every night's a learning experience. And then I had to go back to L.A., and the Lakers always play Friday and Sunday nights in L.A., and they still do to this day. And when I got back home, then I had to play Rick Barry and John Havlicek on Friday and Sunday night. So welcome to the NBA.
Interesting. So were you just 1 year in L.A., or was it two?
1 year.
1 year, okay. And then you were part of the legendary trade for Kareem, right, with the Bucks, and it was you and three other guys or four other guys for Kareem?
Three other guys, myself, Elmore Smith, Junior Bridgman, and Dave Myers, and they had a throw-in named Walt Wesley, but really the deal was for Kareem. Walt Wesley never played for the Lakers, so it was one for four, and I found out I was worth probably one of his limbs. So that worked.
Yeah. So you ended up in Milwaukee, and then you played for another, what, 7 or 8 years there?
Eight years, yeah. Played 8 years. Hurt my back and then had to retire. Just physically got beat up, and it was just, I didn't want to have back surgery, so I retired.
Yeah. Well, you were also a two-time All-Star in Milwaukee, correct? It was twice.
Right.
You made the All-Star game. What years was that? So if you got to Milwaukee in your second year, did you start getting playing time right away and just improve for another year or two and then made the All-Star game, or like when did those All-Star games fit into your career?
Well, the first year I got traded, obviously, you know, they traded for me, and I was on the all rookie team as a rookie with the Lakers, and so I was in my second year, so I started every game my second year, and I played with a guy named Bob Dandridge, who's a great player, and didn't make an All-Star team that year. I think it was the next year I made it. I think it was 77. I think 77 and 79 is when I made it, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. But actually, 78, I had maybe my best statistical year and didn't make it. And so it's just, you know, that's the way it works. But made it for 2 years, and they were great experiences doing that.
Yeah, and you guys had some really good teams there then, right? I mean, you talked about how your Lakers team wasn't very good, but then you got traded, and you guys were very good, really. I mean, almost every year you were getting to the Eastern Conference Finals, right?
Well, we were good. My first year or two there, we were just okay. Bobby Dandridge and I were the two best players, and we lost in the first round twice, and then we missed the year. We didn't make the playoffs, but then we started getting some better talent. We drafted Sidney Moncrief, we drafted Marcus Johnson, then we traded for Bob Lanier, and once we did that, then we were a formidable team. And you know, unfortunately, it was when we were in the Western Conference, and in the late 70s, we played Seattle twice, 2 7-game series, and lost like by one or two possessions in each game at the end. And they went on to the finals both years. And then we got flip-flopped to be an Eastern team from being in the Western Conference. And that's when Julius Erving and Bird got to Boston and Philly. And now we had to play against them. And there was a year we won 61 games, and we were the third place team in the East.
Yeah, that's tough.
You know, you win 61 games, you would think you'd have home court advantage throughout the playoffs, but it didn't happen that way. So, but my last year, unfortunately, I hurt my back before my last year and just getting in shape to play. I blew a disc out and had sciatica down my leg and got through the year, nursed myself through the year, missed a bunch of games, and that was the year we got all the way to the Eastern Conference Finals, and we lost to Philly with Moses Malone and Julius Erving and Maurice Cheeks and Bobby Jones and that group. And they went on and beat the Lakers in the finals. And but unfortunately, I had gotten hurt, and Dave Cowens was our backup center at the time, the Bob Lanier, and he had hurt his knee. If we had stayed healthy, we might have won the championship, but it wasn't to be.
Yeah, interesting. So you had to retire because of your back, and right away that next year is that when you decided to become an assistant coach at Princeton with Pete Carril?
Actually not. I thought, you know, I would try something different, and I went to work for Smith Barney for about a month and a half or 2 months, and then I figured out with my back the way it is, this wasn't going to work, because I was miserable sitting in a chair all day. So I said, you know, and really I was probably better suited to being a coach and being in basketball. So I decided after 3 or 4 months of that, of Smith Barney, that it wasn't for me, and I left. And then I waited till the spring, and then I went looking for a college coaching job, which I ended up getting with Pete Carril at Princeton, and spent, you know, moved the family and spent 2 years with Pete, and it was a great experience. Pete is a Hall of Fame coach and tremendous basketball mind, and just a unique guy. So, and it was a good experience. So,
how were the teams at Princeton when you were there?
They were just okay. We were in like 15, 16 game type things. We don't have any world beaters. You know, Joe Scott was our point guard, who has been the coach at Air Force in Denver, and now I think he's down at Georgia as an assistant coach. And then, you know, our next best player was our center, Howie Levy, and he could really pass and make plays from the high post, but he wasn't very athletic. And then John Thompson Jr., who had coached at Georgetown, was one of our forwards at the time. And he was a solid college player, but we didn't have much athleticism. And even Princeton-style offense, which is two-guard front and a lot of back doors, and even that couldn't overcome our lack of athleticism, quite frankly. So,
yeah.
But it was a good experience.
So then, after 2 years there, you moved on to the NBA as an assistant coach,
right,
with Lenny Wilkins with the Cavs. How did that come about?
Well, Wayne Embry had been the general manager who made the trade for Kareem when I was in Milwaukee, and I was still friends with Wayne. And then I saw a rumor in the paper that Wayne might become the general manager of the Cleveland Cavaliers. And so I called him and I said, Wayne, are you getting back in the league? I said, I'd be interested in coming back as a coach if you would have an interest in me. And he said, well, actually, I am. I have a meeting actually with Gordon Gund, who was the owner of the Cavaliers at the time. And actually, Gordon Gund lived in Princeton. So I met Wayne at a restaurant in Princeton, and he said, well, I'll see what I can do. I'll figure it out when I hire a coach. And then I saw he hired Lenny Wilkins, and I played against Lenny's team, and I knew Lenny a little bit. He was a New York guy from Brooklyn, and, you know, having played in the league and played against them, he knew who I was. So I ended up getting, you know, an interview with them, and they brought me on, and we spent 7 years there, and it was a good 7 years. We had good teams.
And that's, you know, part of the reason I ask all the people I interview on here kind of about their first basketball memory is that period in Cleveland is when a lot of my first memories come up, especially some of those ones with the Cavs, like running around the practice facility and climbing through those green mats and stuff while practice is going on. I'm not sure how we were allowed to do that, but but we did. But it was really fun.
Well, I'm sure it was fun. If it got too out of hand, I would have taken care of that.
Yeah. So you guys, I mean, you guys had a bunch of good teams there: Mark Price and Craig Elo, Larry Nance, Brad Doherty, a lot of really good players. And kind of almost like it seems like with your Milwaukee teams, you were a bit unlucky that just so happened that was the time Michael Jordan ended up becoming a superstar, and obviously it's one of his more famous shots is that free throw line jumper against Craig Elo, and that was one of your teams.
Yeah, it was, and it was unfortunate because at that time the league was only, I think, 23 teams, and so you played teams in your conference and your division more often than they do now. And we had played them, I think, Chicago 8 times, and I think we had beat them 6 or 7 out of 8 times. And then Michael took us out in that famous shot, and but that's what great players do. They raise their game to another level, and nobody else gets there. And he did that consistently over his career, not only that shot. But yeah, he took us out, which was unfortunate.
Well, speaking of Michael Jordan, where do you fall in the Michael Jordan versus LeBron debate?
Well, I mean, I think they're both great players. I think you split hairs when you talk about them. To me, LeBron is a little bit more like Magic. I think his first instinct is to make plays and pass. I think Michael Jordan's first instinct was to score, although he could pass very well too. And I look at Michael Jordan as the best closer the game has ever seen. And I also look at him as probably the most tenacious defender that's ever been seen, because if he wanted to shut you out, he would shut you out. Now, other guys have tried, and that doesn't mean LeBron isn't a very good defender himself, but just as an individual defender, Michael Jordan will just shut you out. In fact, he told Chuck Daly at the Barcelona, famous Barcelona Olympics, when the first Dream Team went over there, he says, he told Chuck, I don't care if I score at all. He says, I just want to guard the best player on the other team. And he did. And he shut all those best players on all those other European teams out.
Oh, really? I don't think I've ever heard that story.
Yep. That's what he wanted to do, and that's what he did.
Lenny
had been the assistant coach. Lenny Wilkins was assistant coach to Chuck Daly on that team, and I talked to Lenny about it, and Lenny said, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, that's funny. So you did 7 years in Cleveland, and then Lenny ends up going down to Atlanta to take the head coaching job of the Hawks. So we picked up and moved down there, and you had some more good teams down there with Dominique and some other guys.
Yeah, we got down there initially, and, you know, they had Mookie Blaylock and Dominique and John Konkak and Kevin Willis, probably the best players, and there was some decent bench players. But then we signed Craig Elo, who played with us in Cleveland, to come down there and as a backup player, and he was a great addition. And we ended up winning the East and coaching in the All-Star game. We took a team that had won, like, 38 or 40 games the year before, and we won 57 games with them. And we had to beat out the Bulls team with Phil Jackson coaching and a Pat Riley New York Knicks team to do it. And so we ended up being all-star coaches and won 57 games that year. It was a great year. Unfortunately, Kevin Willis tore his thumb up against the Pacers in the first round of the playoffs, and we never got out of the first round, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah. So 2 years there, and then you ended up taking the Vancouver Grizzlies job. So you were the first ever head coach of the expansion team, Vancouver Grizzlies, which was a wild experience. I mean, I'm sure for you, also for myself and our family, just packing up and moving to Canada. So can you talk about that experience a little bit?
Well, it was probably not the best decision on my part, coaching the expansion team, because usually nobody makes it. The only coach in NBA history probably has coached the expansion and really got through the whole process was Dick Motta with the Dallas Mavericks, but he had just come off winning an NBA title. Other than that, most expansion team coaches don't last very long, and unfortunately that's what happened to me. But you know, I'd been with Lenny Wilkins, and Dick Helm was the other assistant coach. We'd been together for 9 years, which rarely happens in the NBA anymore, that three people stay together, three coaches like that, for that long of a period of time. And I knew I needed to go take a chance, and I took a chance at it, and probably was not the best decision on my part as far as my coaching career, so we went up there, and I loved Vancouver. The people we met were great. I think it was a decent experience for you kids, as I look back.
Yeah, it was fun.
But unfortunately, you know, we were the worst. We had the lowest salary cap in the league, and we had the least amount of talent in the league, and that does not bode well. So we didn't win very many games, and a half a year into my second year, they decided to make a change because they thought they could do it better, and as it turned out, they didn't. And then they moved to Memphis, and it took them another 5 years to even be a playoff team. So it's just a long process to be work in expansion. And, that's just the way that worked.
And Well, then we ended up moving down to Denver, Colorado, where you took an assistant coaching job with the Nuggets that next year and with Bill Hanslick. And we stayed there for another 4 years or so until I finished high school. But in that meantime, you guys all got let go as the Nuggets coaches. And then I think maybe you sat out a year kind of and then ended up taking a job with Golden State as an assistant coach. And was it Dave Cowens hired you, right?
No, actually, Gary St. Jean hired me, but Dave Cowens later became the head coach. But anyway, you know, I came to Denver to coach with Bill, and, you know, again, everybody said, the owner said, oh, we're going to be patient and this, that, and the other thing, and, you know, our best player, we end up trading to Phoenix before the year begins, and I want to say Antonio Davis, but that's not it.
Antonio McDice. Yeah.
So we trade him to, you know, accumulate draft picks and, you know, all sorts of stuff for the future. But you're trading away your best player. And when you do that, you're asking for trouble. And then our next best player, he blows his ACL out about eight or 10 games in. So now we're really behind the
eight ball.
So now we're back to being a, expansion team, basically. And
Who blew his knee out? Who was it?
I'm trying to think. It was a small forward. I'm trying to think of his name. I can't think of his name offhand, but he blew his knee out. And, you know, and we went on to have a miserable year. And so at the end of the year, first year of a three-year contract, and, you know, a new regime, the ownership says, oh, that's it, we're done. Mm-hmm. And so now I'm out of a job again. And so, you know, still getting paid because it's a guaranteed contract, but nonetheless, you're not working. So I said, you know what, maybe it's just time to settle the family down. I'll just stay for a year, take a year off, and then try to get back and work. And so I took a year, and then halfway through the next year, that's when Gary St. Jean called and said they were letting P.J. Carlissimo go, and he was going to go down and coach. And Gary had been one of my coaches in Milwaukee with Don Nelson, so he asked me if I'd come out and help him, so I did. And so I moved out there for about a year and a half by myself, and then we moved the family out a year and a half later, and then we stayed for another two or three years after that.
Right, right, right. Okay, I remember that. So how long were you with Golden State? Was it 3 years, 4 years? I can't remember how long it was.
It was about 4 years, I think, but from the time I started to the time we got done. You know, Gary left to get off the bench, and Dave Cowens took over as the head coach, and he lasted a year and a half, and they wanted to make a change, and then I ended up being the interim coach. So I've done the two worst jobs and coaching jobs in the NBA that you can do in the NBA. I was an expansion team head coach, and I was an interim coach to a dysfunctional team. And, you know, so that ended. And then I ended up getting the, went from there and getting the, a year later, getting the coach to go coach the WNBA.
Oh yeah. That was, that was interesting. So you took the head coaching job for the Indiana Fever.
Right.
You know, what was that like going from the NBA to the WNBA?
Well, it was very different. I mean, total, like, whole different pool of players, and that probably took me a year to figure that out, because I'd watched some of women's basketball, but I didn't know who the really good players were from the average players. And it took me a year to kind of see the whole league, how it worked, what it did, and figure out, you know, the pool of players and what you need to do to win. So my first year was just kind of a real learning experience. I tried to play some Princeton offense, which didn't work very well because our center was really just a low post center. She wasn't someone you could bring up high and throw the ball and run offense through her and make her a passer, that type of thing. And it took about a third of half the year to figure that out, to the point where we had to almost revamp our offense for the second half of the year. And then we did, and we just missed making the playoffs. But then after that, the next 3 years, we had good teams, and you know, we made a run at it, and unfortunately, our best year, Tamika Catchings was our best player, and we were playing Detroit for the Eastern Conference Final in the WNBA, and my best player, Tamika Catchings, blows her Achilles out right before halftime, and that pretty much told the tale. We weren't going to win after that.
Yeah, she was a good player. So you were there how many years? 4 years or 3 years?
Four.
Okay, and then after that, did you sit out another year or two, or did you go?
Yeah, I sat out another year, and I tried to go to work, try to find a job, but there was none to be had. So I sat out for a year, and then I got a call that the Pacers, would you come and scout? And I said, yeah, I'll come and scout. And so then I scouted for about 2 years, I think it was, and then the lockout year, I can't remember what year it was, they had a lockout because they didn't think they were going to have a contract between the owners and the players. And so there was a lockout, and they thought they were going to just have nothing. So about 2 months into it, they said, we're going to have to let you go because I don't think we're going to have a season, and we can't keep all the scouts. So they let me go, and so then I was out of a job again for another year.
Yeah, and then, I mean, did they bring you back on?
And about a year later, I got a call and said, would you want to come back and work? Somebody was leaving, and I said, sure, I'll come back and scout. So then I went back and scout. And then, so now I've been scouting there for about 3 years, or maybe it's four, I can't even remember. And then, you know, my contract's up in September, but they just offered me a new one for 2 to 3 years. So yeah, I'll take it and continue on.
So you, so you've been a scout now in the NBA, and to be clear, you are a college scout. So that,
right,
you know, obviously there's the advanced scouts that just go scout the NBA teams and kind of
right,
write down the plays and do that sort of stuff. You are the college scout, so you're one of
right,
the college scouts, so you are going and watching a ton of college games, and you know, for you're, I guess, kind of the West Coast scout. So you're based out of Denver, and you fly all around or drive all around and watch a lot of the West Coast, Midwest, Pacific Northwest. You know, all, like those types of teams, like the Kansases and Gonzagas and teams like that. And you've been scouting now for, I don't know, how long? 6, 7, 8 years now?
Yeah, it's been about that, 7 or 8 years probably now, yeah.
Yeah, a bit more stability in scouting, I guess, right?
Yeah, there is, unless there's another lockout. But, yes. But, you know, it's interesting in Denver, and I cover, as you said, I cover from Kansas and Nebraska all the way to the West Coast, and I have, you know, Arizona, California, Nevada, Oregon, Washington, et cetera, and any of the Dakotas, if there's any players up there. But what's interesting living here in Denver, I can go to Omaha and see Big East games. I can go to Kansas and see Big 12 games. I can see Pac-12 games here in Colorado, or I go to the West Coast and see them, and I can see Mountain West games. And then I can go down, you know, I can even go, if I need be, go to Missouri and see SEC games.
Right.
So, you know, even though I my main focus is on the West, I get to see a lot of different conferences and a lot of different players. And, you know, and especially you get to see them when you go to, like, Thanksgiving tournaments and Christmas tournaments and that type of thing. And then at the end of the year, we do what we call a crossover. I'll go and watch the ACC tournament or the Big Ten tournament or the SEC tournament. I go back east and watch those players. And the scouts that have been based in the Midwest and the East, they come west and watch all the players that I've been watching all year. So we get a good cross reference on all the college players in America.
Yeah. Who, if you had the number one draft pick this past season, what would you have? I mean, DeAndre Ayton was one of your guys that you covered a lot because he was at Arizona. Would you have picked him over Bagley?
I would have picked him. From my own, we make our own personal, like, top 60 list. But our team as a group would have probably picked Bagley, but mm-hmm. I would have picked Ayton. So,
yeah. So are you allowed to tell us who your top five were?
Sure. I guess at this point it doesn't matter. Bagley, Ayton, Dunsick, Jackson, and Bamba.
Wait, but that was not in order, right? Because you're. Or was that the Pacers' order?
That's our order.
What was your personal order?
My personal order would have been Ayton, Bagley, Dunsick. Actually, I had Dunsick fifth. I would have had Bamba, Jackson, and then Dunsick. I would have taken him fifth.
Who's Jackson?
Jaren Jackson, who played at Michigan State,
right.
Big 6'11", 7-foot center.
Right. What number did he end up going?
Boy, that's a good question. Right around 4 or 5. I can't remember exactly what team he went to.
Okay, interesting.
Well, I can tell you where he went. Let's see here. He went 4 to Memphis.
Memphis. Okay.
Dunsick went three to Atlanta, but then they traded for Trae Young. They flip-flopped.
Right.
3 and 5 flip-flopped. Trae Young ended up in Atlanta. Dunsick ended up in Dallas.
Hey, well, speaking of Trae Young, what do you think about the Trae Young-Steph Curry comparisons?
I think offensively it's valid. I think, you know, Trae Young is very quick. He's got deep range. He has a nice floater game in the lane. He had a skinny body, kind of like, Steph had in college. But he's not as tall. He's only 6'1 or 2, whereas Steph's 6'3", 4. And he's not a good defender, Trae Young, not particularly. Not that, you know, Steph was a great defender either in college, but, you know, I just saw the length and the potential for it. And
Steph's a little bigger. I think a lot of people don't realize that, right? Like, I mean, Steph's 6'3", 6'4", and Trae Young's, right. What, 6'1"?
Yeah, 6'1", 2, maybe 6'2". And, you know, so he's going to have to become a better defender, and he's going to have to improve his body. His body has to get a lot stronger.
Yeah. Who would you compare DeAndre Ayton to?
Oh, boy.
Like the athleticism of like a Dwight Howard, but it seems like he's got a bit more skills in terms of a shooting touch and things like that. Is that?
Yeah, he's an extremely athletic player. I mean, he can run, jump. He's got over a 40-inch vertical. He's strong as can be. But he has a touch. I've seen him make some college threes. So he already can do that, and that'll probably get nothing but better. He's just such an active guy, and he can block shots. He's just, he's just a tremendous physical specimen that has, you know, some touch and feel and understanding of how to play, and a solid passer to boot.
Is there an older player that you might compare him to?
Boy, I'm trying to think offhand who it would be. Man, I can't think of anybody offhand. He's unique in his own way.
What about Bagley? Do you think he's is he a better version of Chris Bosh? I mean Chris Bosh is really good, or is that kind of the level that you see him at?
I think he's a better low post player than Chris Bosh, but he's not as good a perimeter shooter as Chris Bosh. Mm-hmm. Chris Bosh had a tremendous perimeter shooting touch, and Bagley struggles from the free throw line, and he can make an elbow jumper, but he does not have 3-point range, where Chris Bosh was always a good shooter, and he eventually became a pretty darn good 3-point shooter.
Yeah.
So a little different in that regard, but similar. They're both lefty. They're both long and tall and lanky, and but Bagley's going to be a very good player.
What about in Jaren Jackson? Who do you compare him to?
I don't know. I'm trying to think of I'm not really great on comparisons. I just try to evaluate them for who they are. He's very athletic. He has the ability to make a three already. Can really drive to his left, surprisingly, for a right-handed player and a big player. He loves to drive to his left and finish with his left hand, especially around the rim. When he's got some jump hooks around the rim, he's just a pretty versatile player for a big kid. And he can block some shots, too. He's a pretty good left-handed shot blocker, and that's good playing against right-handed players to be able to block shots with your left hand.
Yeah, interesting. Well, we'll see how it shakes out. It's always interesting to see that. For last year's class, obviously Jason Tatum had a really good year, mm-hmm. and you have Ben Simmons, who he won Rookie of the Year, correct?
Right, he did. Yeah. It was really his second year because he had missed his whole first year with an ACL tear.
Right, so who... Would you go with Jason Tatum if you had to pick someone from last year's draft class?
Yeah, I mean, I thought Fultz was pretty good, but for whatever reason, he lost his confidence in his shooting and didn't hardly play the whole year. And I liked him a lot, but Jason Tatum certainly is a terrific player. I mean, he's going to score a tremendous amount of points in the NBA. He's quite a player, and great pick.
What about the Pacers currently? Who are the young guys you like on that team? Miles Turner, right?
Miles Turner and Sabonis are two best big guys. And then, the rest of our team is solid. But we drafted Aaron Holiday from UCLA. That was our first-round pick of the 23rd pick. And then we picked a guy named Alize Johnson, who went to Missouri State. He's a 6'9 forward, active rebounder kind of guy. Not a great offensive player, but, a good player. And, and the rest of our team is solid veteran guys. Oladipo, obviously, he and Sabonis came in the trade for Paul George, and they, changed our team quite a bit. But then after that, we just have some very solid players pretty much everywhere else. We need to probably sign some free agents if we can. And we'll never get a top free agent because we're a small market city more than likely. But unless a guy just grew up there and wants to come to Indiana and play, we need to sign some mid-level free agents, and if we can do that, then hopefully that'll happen, and we'll see. And we just let Lance Stephenson go just the other day, so he's not going to be on our team. So we need to replace, hopefully we can replace with some kind of decent-sized guard, 6'5", 6-type guard, wing player that can help us.
Yeah, interesting. I want to, just quickly – change topics. I mean, and end it on this subject. For those people out there who aren't familiar with either my story or, maybe you are, but you probably don't know, this is my family's story in terms of my brothers and sisters. So I played at Davidson, had some struggles in high school and on the basketball side, but then once I got to Davidson, blossomed and ended up playing professionally overseas. But we also have a younger brother who played at Elon, a younger sister who played at Gonzaga basketball-wise, and then a younger sister who also played at Portland for soccer, and then professionally for soccer as well. So there's six kids in our family, and four out of six ended up playing sports in college, mostly basketball. So just in case there's any parents listening out there, you know, Dad, what advice would you give to parents out there in terms of raising kids who are in competitive sports, and, you know, maybe kids that dream about playing in college and maybe one day pro? What advice would you give to them about raising their kids from a in terms of being a competitive sports parent?
Well, I guess first of all, I think sport in general, no matter whether it's basketball or soccer or baseball, whatever you choose for your child or your child chooses for themselves, just encourage them, give them all the things they need to try to be successful. Encourage them, tell them it's hard work, and don't live vicariously through them. It has to be something they want to do. It can't be that something that you as a parent want for them, because then you live vicariously through their experiences, and sometimes that leads to trouble. So just encourage, get them into the best programs you can find, the best coaching you can find, and let the coaches do their jobs, and let your child be a child. Try not to, you know, say, okay, you have to do this so you can get a scholarship. You have to do that to make the NBA. You have to do this to do that. Don't put that kind of pressure on them, you know, because if you do, and even if they're successful, they won't enjoy it. You know, it has to be something that comes from their heart and their want and their desire to be good. And I tried to tell all of you that I was always wary of, especially you boys, and even with Megan going to Gonzaga to play basketball, that you had to live up to who I was. All I cared about was I wanted you to be the best that you could be as an individual, that you liked what you were doing, you were willing to put the time in, the work in. I was willing to show you the time, give you the respect, to try to teach as much as I could about basketball in particular. But I wanted you to, you know, experience coaching, experience being around other players, all the things that come along with sports, communication, teamwork, unselfishness. All of those things come from sports, and they're all good things, and they're all qualities you can use through the rest of your life, whether you play in high school, not play in high school, play in college, not play in college. Like our daughter Carrie, your older sister, you know, ran track and played basketball, won two state championships. And I asked her, said, do you want to play sports in college? And she said, no. And I said, fine, I have no problem with that. I said, just go and get your best education you can, just so that you have a good entree to life with your college education. And I had no problem with her backing away from sport, even though I knew she probably could have either ran track or even maybe played basketball in college. Keelan, who played soccer and professional soccer, could have been a college point guard easily. But she chose soccer over basketball, and I respected her wishes in that. And that I said, good, that's what your love is, and that's what your heart tells you to do, then that's what you should do. And it was a great experience for her. So all kids are different, but I think you have to let them make their own decisions, encourage them, get them the best coaching you can, but don't live vicariously through them, and let them be who they are and as good as they can be.
Yeah, well, that's great advice, and appreciate you sharing that with us. I think there's a lot of parents that could use that advice. And, you know, from my perspective, one thing that really stands out to me now as a youth basketball organization administrator or director, whatever you want to call it, and, you know, I used to coach quite a bit in our organization. I don't so much anymore. I'm more in the background, is that you were an NBA player and an NBA coach, yet I never remember you ever going to, well, A, yelling or saying anything from the stands, yelling at the refs, yelling at the coach, you know, even though you knew more than 99.9% of them out there, you never, you know, requested meetings behind closed doors with coaches about playing time, about whatever. And as I said, there were times when I really struggled, and, you know, my other siblings, I think, struggled, and you know, there's maybe that temptation there. But it's interesting that you never did that stuff, even though you knew more than the high school coaches and the other, you know, a lot of the other people in the youth basketball world, but yet that's a huge thing nowadays, is that parents who know a lot of parents who know really nothing about basketball or whatever sport it might be are trying to give tactical advice or substitution pattern advice, or, you know, requesting meetings and causing a ruckus, you know, at games and things like that, when really they don't know much about that sport. And whereas conversely, you knew a whole lot about basketball and never, you know, got involved with that whole side of things.
Well, I didn't, and I didn't want to. I felt it was best that if there was an issue, whether it was between one of my children, one of you or your sisters or brothers, and there was an issue, and if they told me about it, I would suggest that they go in and they be the ones to talk to the coach and not me. And that gave you more responsibility, and it was a better way for them to learn to talk to an adult in the right manner. And maybe you can have an exchange that's profitable. Maybe you will get the answer you like, but you also find out you always don't get what you like. And there's a lot of people with a little knowledge about a sport, and it can be a dangerous thing. You know, but I never wanted to confront anybody. In fact, I'll tell you one story. I was in a stand watching one of you kids play. I can't remember who it was. And I was sitting with this guy who I knew, and he seemed like a perfectly great guy. But then the game started, and all of a sudden he just started yelling at the officials like I couldn't believe. And I had to get away from him in the stands. And after the game, I walked up to the two referees after the game, and I said, you know what? I was sitting by that guy that was yelling at you the whole time, and I want to apologize for him because he had no right to do that. You two did a great job refereeing the game. You didn't make all the right calls, but you did a great job. And so don't listen to people like that.
Yeah, you know, that's, I'm not sure if you're aware, but that's a big problem in youth sports today, is the referees are getting berated more and more and more and abused more and more and more, which is causing less and less people to want to get into refereeing, which in turn is causing a shortage of referees. And that's like a huge problem today in baseball, football, basketball especially, is that there's a big shortage of referees, and a lot of it stems from the abuse like you just mentioned. So yeah, it's just interesting. I think a lot of parents could learn from that, but I like that quote you said. I don't know if you just made it up or if that's actually a legitimate quote you heard somewhere, about a lot of parents with a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing. a little bit of sports knowledge or a little bit of basketball knowledge is a dangerous thing, because that we certainly find that out on a weekly basis, sort of thing. But hey, well, I want to wrap this up and really appreciate you taking some time to come on to the podcast. It was awesome. I actually, you know, like I said, I asked you some questions that I didn't know the answers to, and then you also offered up some stuff that I didn't know. So I think it was really fun. And yeah, thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you, Brad. I appreciate it. I enjoyed doing it. And if there's anything else in the future that you'd like to do, I'm always available.
Yeah, well, if you keep dropping nuggets like that last quote, we'll bring you on for another series where we can just talk about youth sports parenting.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, you know, unfortunately, in this day and age, there's a lack of civility on a lot of levels, and it's somewhere. Sometimes it starts in youth sports, and that's not a good thing. It's not a good thing for our society. You don't teach your children the right way to behave if you, as a parent, act in a way that's, not a right manner. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Well, I agree. So, all right. Well, Dad, appreciate it, and I'll be talking to you soon.
Okay, Brendan.
All right, thanks. See ya. Yeah.